across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. Well, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, certainly whether you are a veteran or just simply a friend of a veteran, or maybe your kids are currently in the military or have been in the military. Thank you for your support, for all that you do, as mom's job's never done and never easy. So we certainly appreciate that and want to recognize that. And so today we're going to have a special interview. We're going to talk about Shannon Kent. She was an incredible patriot, fierce warrior, a Navy cryptologist, ultimately gave her life on an overseas assignment in Syria. But she herself was a mother. We're going to talk to her husband. And you're going to find this a great story, inspirational story, in a new book out called Send Me, which is taken from Isaiah 6 and to 8, where it's asked, "Whom shall I send?" And Shannon Kent answered that call. Got to say, my sound quality on this interview makes me sound like I'm deep in a tunnel, but I wasn't. But the sound quality is excellent as to both of our interviewees. So I think you'll enjoy this, even if the sound quality sounds more baritone than normal.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today two veterans themselves. We're going to talk about a book that's coming out here in May of 2024 called Send Me, The True Story of a Mother at War. And we were fortunate to talk to her husband, Joe Kent. Joe, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
And Marty Sokolovin, Jr., who is the editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose, and probably the guy who put pen to paper here. He's a former Army Ranger, which surprises me he could put pen to paper, but maybe it's all that time he was an experienced conflict reporter and working at Task and Purpose. Marty, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks for having me on. And I'll jump right off and say, I'll give Joe a lot of credit here. He put a lot of pen to paper as well to make this book what it was. So
holy cow, you mean a guy who spent 20 years as an Army Ranger and a Green Beret has editorial and writing skills? Way to go, Joe!
lots of repetition there when I was working on the intel side, but that was definitely a challenging skill for me to learn while I was in the military.
Normally, when I'm talking to the Marine writers, they always start, "Well, my first draft was with crayons." So you get a little bit of that. So this is an amazing story of an amazing woman, Shannon Kent, who grew up in New York. Her dad was a state trooper. Her mom was a teacher. Early on, she demonstrated linguistic abilities. Tell me a little bit about the early years and why Shannon decided, hey, I'm going to join the Navy.
Well, 9/11 was the big catalyst. I mean, she had thought about joining the military before. She was very interested in, the world beyond her small town in New York State. She wanted to, eventually join the Foreign Service and the State Department, something along those lines. She taught herself French and Spanish as a kid, so she knew that she could learn languages. But then after 9/11, like you said, her father and her uncle also was a New York City firefighter. So they were both ground zero first responders. So once 9/11 happened, Shannon knew exactly what she needed to do, and she felt called to serve. So she found the first recruiter who would listen to her, and that was actually a Navy recruiter. So she went to all the different services and said, "Hey, I can learn Arabic. The towers just got knocked down by people from the Middle East. I can learn that language." I guess the Army and the Marines gave her the runaround and said, "Hey, you scored really high. We want to teach you Russian or Chinese." And the Navy was the first one who said, "Like, you want to learn Arabic? Okay, sure. Yeah, sign right here, young lady."
Well, and a lot of these stories, you get recruited just sort of that way. It wasn't maybe exactly what you were thinking. Her brother was a Marine, I believe.
So
So.
her and her brother actually, right after 9/11, her brother's about a year younger than her. They both went and found recruiters. And Mike knew that he wanted to be a Marine because the Marines have probably the best recruiting propaganda out there. So Mike had his mind made up. He joined the Marines and Shannon settled on the Navy. But they actually both, because of their father and their uncle, went out and sought out recruiters right after 9/11, like so many warriors of our generation.
Yeah, Joe, you went into the Army, ultimately became a Green Beret. You've also done a number of other special op, classified special op units. What compelled you to join?
I was in before 9/11, so really, I like to say it was a combination of the A Team and G.I. Joe growing up. I don't know, as far back as I can remember, I wanted to be a commando of some sort and read every single Vietnam book I could get my hands on. Eventually decided I wanted to be a Green Beret because they always seemed like they were involved in conflicts and adventures, even if America wasn't necessarily at war. So I was already fully committed by the time 9/11 happened, and that just really, heightened my resolve to stay in and to continue to fight.
Marty Phillipson, why did you join up as an ultimately an Army Ranger?
I did come in after 9/11. I was a freshman or sophomore in high school when that happened, and certainly that solidified the idea that I was going to go directly into the military after I graduated high school. But similar to Joe, I grew up reading those Vietnam memoirs, and almost every male in my family had served in the military, so I grew up around those people. Even in high school, one of my uncles who's in the Air Force, he was like an OIF-1 guy. So I still remember sitting on the phone in the kitchen talking to him overseas in Iraq, and it just it, the entire I think my entire world just kind of pushed me in that direction, and there was never really any idea other than I'm going to go join the Army. And I think it was a com I specifically wanted to be a Ranger because of a combination of seeing Black Hawk Down and then reading the news reports about Thakur Gar. I wrote a high school report on Roberts Ridge or the Battle of Thakur Gar. And that really, I think between that and Black Hawk Down really solidified the idea of like, I don't want to just join the Army. I want to be an Army Ranger and, go, they seem to be where the fight is. And I wasn't wrong.
Well, veteran radio listeners, so we're talking to two real committed patriotic men here, but the real emphasis on this discussion is an incredible woman, Shannon Kent, who joined the Navy and had this incredible career as a linguist and cryptologist. Joe, explain to the regular folk out there what a Navy cryptologist does.
Yeah, it's a really long way to say that she steals enemy signals. So basically, if it comes out of a cell phone, it comes out of a computer, a radio transmission, she was trained to tack into it, to steal it, to decode it. But then a big issue with that is that usually it's in a foreign language. And so you'll get cryptologists that have the ability to do all the stuff with the ones and the zeros and actually steal the signal. But then you get people like Shannon who are dual trained to not only steal the signal, but then if it comes through in Arabic and multiple dialects of Arabic, that she can then translate it into actual intelligence.
She went, and this is typical in the military, right? The defense, the DoD has a linguistics classes that they put you through. But these were things that she amazingly excelled at. Talk to us about some of that training and commitment to really go in depth as an Arabic speaker.
Yeah, so she went to the Defense Language Institute out at Monterey, California, and it's interesting. You know, you always hear about the training that Rangers go through and Green Berets go through, but you don't really hear about things like DLI because it just doesn't make for really cool video. However, it's some of the most challenging training that I think people in the military can undergo. It's 18 months of intensive language instruction where they take people from all over the United States of America who might not ever heard one word of a foreign language before, and they take them and they make them not just proficient, but they make them fluent in reading, writing, and speaking in about 18 months. And so that was, I think, Shannon's kind of dream job. So she got to be very deeply immersed in Arabic. But as anyone knows, as most people know, Arabic's a very complicated language. There's modern standard Arabic, but then there's different dialects. And Shannon really found a niche in the different dialects. When she finally got over to Iraq, she got pretty obsessed with how Iraqis actually talked versus, you know, modern standard Arabic that she had learned in Monterey. And she had that ear. It's the same ear I think that musicians have. She was also musically inclined. I Green Berets, we have to learn language as well. We don't need to learn it quite to that level. And one time when I was studying Arabic, I asked Shannon, like, what's the secret? How are you so good at this? And with a straight face, she said, well, you just listen to someone, a native speaker, say the word, and then you remember it, and then you say it exactly like they said it. I was like, okay, our brains are not exactly wired the same way. That's not how mortal men learn language.
Yeah, you learn how to order a beer and a few other things, and you know she's actually it was incredible in reading the book Send Me that is coming out here in May of 2024. The focus that she had and her ability to pick up different dialects, and this isn't a sit-at-home job, is it? This isn't in a nice, comfy office in D.C. or in Monterey, California. Tell us about her overseas assignment and multiple deployments, Joe.
So it's interesting, you know, she initially volunteered right out of language school to go over to Iraq on what the Navy calls an individual augmentation. So she wasn't part of a unit that all deployed together, like Marty and I deployed. She deployed as an individual, and she basically could have gotten put anywhere, but she ends up at the Special Operations Task Force. And they essentially say, hey, your job is to help us intercept enemy communications and then to translate them. However, at the time, there was a high demand for people to go out and actually interact with Iraqis on the ground. And that was not what a lot of people wanted to do. They wanted to go kick in the doors and do the sexy type of direct action missions. But Shannon said, hey, I actually really enjoy talking to these people. I've got a knack for the language. And so, because of that ability to go out and talk with actual Iraqis and collect human intelligence, she got put right on the front lines, and a SEAL team eventually put her with them as a part of their element to actually help them go out and track down bad guys. So really, I mean, Shannon's career is just a story of her volunteering to be at the tip of the spear and then proving her worth, usually based on her ability to understand the language, but then also to really understand the human factor. And because she got so good at human intelligence, she really became quite the threat, because usually human intelligence collectors are separate from signals intelligence collectors, that sometimes are even separated from linguists. Shannon basically was a one-stop shop, and that's why she ended up down there on the ground level with a special operations task force, way before women were even allowed anywhere near combat arms.
Marty, maybe you want to expand on this. She was an incredible woman warrior, fierce, focused, intelligent. Talk to us about how unusual it is for a cryptologist, let alone a woman cryptologist, to find herself at the pointy end of the spear with special operations.
I think that the way we have to look at Shannon's trajectory through the military is put it in context of what was going on within the larger special operations world at that time. Shannon came in at a time when special operations was evolving from very siloed units, like SEALs stuck with SEALs, Rangers with Rangers, you know, so on and so forth. And basically, what happened throughout the Joint Special Operations Command and some initiatives that happened in the mid-aughts there was they started bringing everybody together, and they needed intelligence to be that connective tissue throughout the organization. And so, if you had somebody like Shannon come along, like Joe said, that was kind of a one-stop shop, could speak all the different languages, not just literally Arabic or French or Spanish, but the languages of the different special operations units and their cultures and that sort of thing. She was able to be that connective tissue, and she was able to get into these positions and get so close to the tippy point of the spear there and going out on missions, doing, you know, taking part in direct action raids, all this sort of stuff, because she was able to get there before anybody was even asking if this is okay. You just had commanders on the ground over there saying, hey, this is a value add to my team. Our organization is changing to be more like, we need to have the people in place, share intelligence, and have people that are enabling the mission to be as effective as it could. I mean, it was an industrialized scale of network-centric warfare happening in Iraq back in the mid-aughts. And somebody like Shannon, you skipped right past, oh, can we have a woman with us, straight to, oh my God, she's somebody that can directly impact our mission and make us more successful on the battlefield. And so I don't think people even asked the question if it was okay. She just went right into it.
It's one of those things where I think once you demonstrate yourself and that ability, the respect comes. She had a focus always to keep earning that respect and trained hard, both in physically to be in physical shape to stay with special operations, but also linguistically. She would listen, Joe, to Arabic news broadcasts at home when she was stateside to keep her language skills sharp. I mean, that's incredible to me.
And, you know, the physical side is really interesting in that a lot of times, Joe and I have probably worked with a lot of guys and gals that come on as enablers or support. And, you know, there's questions on whether they can keep up, right, from a physical perspective. And Shannon was one of those people, from what I understand, there was never any question on whether she could keep up. And in fact, helped out a lot of folks as far as that, making them better runners, better at swimming, better at some of these things that she was, you know, physically gifted in. So it's not like she was just a great intel analyst or a great human intel collector or a great linguist. She had all the physical attributes that you expect out of somebody that's working at the highest levels of special operations.
The other thing that I think is important to get across here is something that I read. Joe, you first met Shannon, I think in like 2007, I think it was. She was all business, no flirtation. She was there for the mission and focused on the mission, if I'm reading this right. And I'm trying to find the date, but it took you a while. You ended up bumping into each other stateside somewhere along the line before anything else happened. But the importance of having respect and being all business is one of those messages that I think is important for some people to hear, and it probably impressed you as well.
Yeah, I really did. I mean, she was all business despite my best efforts. I should caveat that. She was professional. I probably was a little bit less professional. But yeah, no, I actually met her at the embassy complex in 2007. I was over there just trying to match up some of the intelligence that my human sources were reporting back with some of the signals intelligence people. And I literally just walked into a brief that Shannon was giving on a target that I was chasing. And I was really impressed, not, you know, obviously by how she looked, but also the fact that she really knew her stuff. And she was, I would say, doing much more common sense analysis than usually I would find at an intelligence-centric organization like she was working in at the time. And I actually met her about a week or two. We figured this out years later. I met her a week or two before the SEAL team brought her down to where the teams were deploying every night going after bad guys. But she was there and she was tying together the pieces in a way that really impressed me. And that was my fourth combat deployment. So I kind of thought that I knew what was going on. And the way that she was taking the human factor and overlaying that with her knowledge of Iraqi culture in order to hunt down bad guys, to put them into time and space so that we could kill them, was incredibly impressive to me as somebody who had just really dedicated my life to the Iraq deployments at that time. Just seeing that Shannon was equally as committed to me was really, really impressive and something that stuck with me for many years until we actually ended up stationed at the same unit together years later.
And I mentioned earlier her intelligence and her focus, but I think there's also, as you read the book, there's this positivity, but humility and humor that she had, Joe, that kind of took her to another place in terms of how people viewed her.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, she just had a very humble personality, but very, very humorous. Always had a joke, never really took herself or a situation too seriously. Which, you know, I think a lot of people who've never been in a high stress, high performing environment, like a special operations task force, you kind of tend to think that it's a very serious environment, and it is. But I personally think the true professionals are the ones who can usually rise above the situation and keep a certain degree of calm. And Shannon just exuded that in spades. I could tell from the time that we met, and then and once we met again later on in life and started dating. I mean, she had, I would say, almost the same demeanor as a lot of really experienced special operators who had just kind of been there and done that. And that was the way that she carried herself. Never had any ego. She was always quick to mentor, you know, the sailors and other troops below her. That was actually really one of her hobbies. She'd have people over to her house who were struggling at work. She started a swim program and a run program for some of the people that were below her in rank that were having a hard time in that realm. So that was just her nature, I think, as a human, but then also as a just as a mother and as a wife and everything that she was.
And maybe Mari, I'll ask you to talk about it. Shannon did, I think it was five overseas deployments. Joe did, I think, 11 combat deployments. Mari, tell us what happened on the last deployment for Shannon.
Yeah, so I really think the way that I look at her different deployments, her fifth deployment was really the pinnacle of her professional career as far as what she was doing. I think she was at the very highest level doing things that so few people can or will do in a very dynamic environment. I mean, Syria in 2019 was kind of unlike anything we'd ever seen before, as far as like a geopolitical environment. I mean, it was a very complicated place where a mistake could cause a lot of problems at an international scale, right? We've got it in the book somewhere where one of the guys that we talked to that was also working that theater is like, I mean, we're literally looking at Russian flags, and you know, right across the way. And I mean, it was a very dynamic environment and a lot of places for things to go wrong, and you needed trusted professionals like Shannon. Shannon and Joe both were people that were a little bit of an anomaly, even within special operations, and the fact that they stayed at the tactical level throughout their entire career. I mean, it was usually people move on to sort of administrative leadership sort of positions. They were both very much at the ground level, like doing the job. And so for Shannon, that was her deployment. She was doing key leader engagements. She was doing source meets. She was very involved in shaping what was going on in Syria at that time in regard to a post-ISIS sort of mess that was there. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, on January 16th of 2019, a suicide bomber came into walked into the middle of their element as they were getting ready to leave an area they were working at, that they were working in Manbij, Syria, and it took the life of her as well as three other Americans and injured many more and killed many other Syrian Defense Forces as well. And it's a very, and as you read it in the book, even, it was a very tragic but very abrupt end to an incredible person's life. And that's one thing, you know, for Joe and the rest of her family, I imagine it was very, like, it's the last thing that they expected. You consider when a family member goes off to war that that's certainly a possibility, but the odds are in your favor. Most people who go to war, at least in the 21st century, they come back from war, right? Like, maybe not in one piece all the time, but most of they're coming back alive usually. And so you just figure the odds in your favor. So her dying after such a long career of doing incredible work and as a mother and kids, and it was very abrupt. And so we tried to, one of my hopes with the book, as people come to know Shannon throughout the book, is that they experience even 1/1000th of the pain and just loss that Joe and her family felt when they found out, you know.
She's an incredible person, and we always like go out of our way on Veterans Radio to pay honor to those who are lost. And along with Shannon that day, it was Jonathan Farmer, a Green Beret, Scott Wirtz, a civilian intelligence officer she worked with a lot, and Gadara Tara, a Syrian-born contractor who had returned to Syria to be an interpreter for the U.S. military. All four of those folks lost their life on a suicide bomb event on January 16th, 2019. The recognition, this doesn't do the family any good, but it's important, I think, for society the recognition Shannon got in death is substantial. The country honored her, the Navy honored her, the chiefs in the naval honored her. She was the first enlisted service person to be in state at the Naval Academy. She's buried at Arlington. The number of speakers and commentators about her incredible patriotism. And I'm sure it, as I say, it doesn't do any good for the family at the time, but I think it's important and certainly one way society recognizes these heroines who have been out there working so hard. Now, I had to read 200 pages to get to the title of the book. And then when I got there, I went, it's so obvious. And the book Send Me, the true story of a mother at war, Send Me comes from a biblical quote, Isaiah 6-8, where it's asked, whom shall I send, Lord? And the response is, send me. And that really captured up Shannon's spirit, right? She could have ducked out six different ways on these deployments, but she really responded with that send me approach, didn't she, Joe?
She did. I mean, that was how we lived our lives. I mean, that's why I that was really what attracted me to her in the first place, and then why we decided to get married. I mean, it's we cover it in the book. One of our first dates, we just sort of talked about, like, hey, why are we doing this? You know, why are you still in the military? Because that we, you know, established we both had multiple deployments, and we were both just very much committed to our country, to our fight, to the our brothers and sisters on our left and right. And we both figured, hey, if someone's gonna go, it should be us. And as we were talking about Shannon's final deployment, we talk about this a lot in the book. That was very challenging for our family. She had another path that was kind of carved out for her that would have left her back in the States. That didn't work out because of some catch 22 types of reasons. But she could have gotten out of that final deployment. And I know there was a lot of her and me that was saying, hey, you should just get out of this deployment. I mean, you're a mom now. It's completely different. No one's going to think any less of you if you get out of it. But at the end of the day, Shannon said, no, if people are going to go and they're going to be in harm's way, why am I any different? I have all the skills. I should be the one that goes forward and fights for our country. And so that's why we titled the book that way. And that's just how Shannon lived her life.
Selfless sacrifice. It's incredible. Marty, as the executive editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose, this has to be, you see many stories, but this one just have to be right at the top of the list.
And it's not even my work in journalism. I mean, that's certainly part of it. I've seen a lot of these stories. I've been to a lot of memorials for fallen service members. There's, you know, I know this world pretty well. When I went down to meet Joe in Virginia, or the Maryland, Virginia, DC area there where they lived. And, I still very vividly remember sitting down at a table to talk to Joe and one of their family friends, Ali, and kind of doing the initial interview. And then it was, I think, the next day that we went to the memorial at the Naval Academy. And that was when it really hit me how much of an impact Shannon had had on this world, on the military, on the special ops community, on this world. You know, she had had such an impact that the people that came out for that, it was unlike anything that I had seen. You know, like I said, it's not the first memorial for a fallen service member I'd ever been to. It was unlike anything that I'd ever seen. And even through writing that initial article about her, you go through some of it and there's times where I'm almost like, man, I couldn't make this up. Like, this is something that you almost, like, if you're trying to write like a Jason Bourne character or something like that, you would maybe come up with some of this stuff. Like, she was, but this is a real person that really possessed these capabilities, but also the capacity for being a mother, for being a wife, for a sister, a friend, a mentor, like all these other things that you don't typically associate with the, you know, the cold-hearted killer special operator, right? Like, but she was able to do all of those things. And I really, you know, when I first saw the first news report when it came out, obviously I have to follow the news pretty closely. And I saw the first articles come out on January 16th about an explosion in Syria. And then a couple in the days after where they released the names after the families had been notified. And they were framing this as like they were out to lunch or something, like this was some sort of like joyride that they were doing in Manbij. But even I knew at that time, looking at okay, Scotty Wirtz, Shannon Kent, John Farmer, Gadeer, like, this isn't the, Jonah, I've said it a couple of different times, this wasn't the going out to lunch crowd. Like, this wasn't the people that were just messing around in a war zone. Like, you just, those types of people aren't together in a war zone for messing around, you know?
It's all business. And again, it's an inspiring story. I hope many, many young women pick this up and read it and are inspired by Shannon's focus, dedication, intelligence, positivity, humility, all of those things which come through in the book. Send me. Gentlemen, if you've got a few more minutes, I'd like to go to the third area that I want to talk about. But it's totally up to you. If you don't have time, I understand.
No, I'm good. Yeah. Yep.
This is sort of above and beyond the book, if you will, but it comes out through the book, and I think it's an important message for the civilian community to understand. And Joe, you really lived it here with Shannon, and that's the importance of family. Both you have two boys, both as parents, the importance of being able to deploy and take care of the kids, but also sisters, mothers, friends, cousins. Talk to us a little bit about the importance of family for those who are deploying.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly important, especially if you have kids. I mean, I was pretty fortunate. I did the vast majority of my deployments before I was married, before I had kids. And so that definitely gave me a different view of deploying. And I actually I've gone back in years since and kind of apologized to some of my teammates who had kids and had families. And like, I was living this great adventure and wondering why they were, you know, having some sort of struggles at home and things like that. But it is very challenging. And so if you don't have a spouse that that understands why you're in the fight and has equally committed to you, it's going to be very difficult. And I was very blessed to have Shannon in my life, because she understood exactly what I was going to go do whenever I deployed, when we were married and had kids. But then also having a family support system. I mean, my parents were absolutely amazing. They would always fly out if I was gone or if Shannon was gone to help us out with the kids and just to be there. Shannon's sister lived with us for a year after our first son was born, and was basically, you know, when Shannon and I were both off at work, or I deployed for a big part of that year, and it was Shannon and her sister there with my first son, with our first son, Colt. And then, you know, once Shannon deployed again, both my parents came back out. Shannon's parents came down quite a bit. And then just a robust network too of friends. I mean, the longer you're in the military, the more people, you know, get married and have kids and those types of things. And so you do end up really supporting each other. And Shannon had a really great community up there in the Fort Meade area of other working mothers, you know, who were going through some of the same struggles as well as her. And so they were able to support each other. And so it's something that doesn't get talked about anywhere near enough. I think as we discuss going off and deploying to war, how important that home structure is and just how vital the family is.
We have a recruiting problem in this country that's well documented. And part of it, I think, are, you know, parents who don't have any exposure to the military lifestyle think in part their kids, whether it be a boy or a girl, a young man, a young woman, are going to be lonely, that they're not going to have family, that there's not going to be this community or network around. But one really develops, and Marty, I'm sure you saw that as well in your time in the service.
Yeah, I so on the tail end of my military career, I was a recruiter, and there is a big gap between what parents think the military is and families think the military is and what it actually is. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is service. You are going to go do something that is not always going to be comfortable, that is going to make complications for you at home and in family. And to Joe's point, if you've got people in your life that understand that and are able to support that and support you, that makes all the difference in the world. It really does. I didn't do any of my deployments with kids. I was with my wife through four out of my five deployments, but we didn't have any kids or anything like that. I look back on it now. I totally know what you're saying, Joe. Like, I look back at the guys I deployed with who had families and kids. I'm like, I don't know how they did it. I literally cannot understand what it would take to be able to go through that. And Joe, even at the tail end of your career with you still deploying and having to say, you know, kiss the kids goodbye. Like, I mean, that is a level of service that I don't think most people will ever, ever understand.
And we don't give enough credit to the mothers who do this, right? Joe, everybody's focusing on what an incredible warrior Shannon was and selfless she was. But she brought that same sort of energy to being a mother, didn't she?
Yeah, she most certainly did. I mean, Shannon somehow squeezed 25 to 26 hours out of every single day. I mean, that was just her personality. She really just went all in on everything that she did, including being a mom. I mean, she carved out a ton of time for our sons. She was there, you know, when they woke up in the morning, she was there when they would go to sleep at night. That's another reason why her fifth deployment was just, it was so painful for her to actually say goodbye and leave the boys. And it was a much bigger conversation that we had, and just a very hard lift for her. But I mean, she put a ton of zeal into being a mother. I mean, it's crazy now that I look back on it. There was so much that Shannon was doing to make memories, to document our memories. She made these great family albums and these family books that when she was doing it, I thought she was a little bit like obsessive. It's like, what's the timeline? Why do you have to do this? Like, right. I mean, she would make sure that she did them, you know, basically every year on the year. She was just really good about making memories, making every meal special, decorating our house of artwork that she made that was, you know, that represented both of the boys. I mean, she was just, Shannon did not do anything halfway. She did everything all the way, and she loved our sons and was a great wife, you know, 100% of the time. So it's just, she's just an amazing human and loved everyone in her family, and then also just her military family as well.
And some of this is just, again, I think the civilian world doesn't get this. It's perfectly normal stuff that military moms are doing. They're making the garden out back. They're cooking special meals. She had an artistic talent with the mosaics. As you mentioned, I'll call it scrapbooking. I don't know if that's the right term. But all that's normal mother stuff that civilian and military moms have together. And we need to kind of get it across to folks that it can be a great life, and you can do all these things, can't you, Joe?
Yeah, you certainly can. I mean, our neighbors in our neighborhood, really, they knew that Shannon was in the military. I think they thought that she was like a translator that worked at Fort Meade and kind of had an office job. It wasn't until she deployed and she was killed they really understood what she did, because she was out there, you know, pushing the stroller with all the other moms. I mean, they were all making gardens together, just, you know, very normal, everyday 9-to-5 stuff. I think they knew that I had this neat title of like being a Green Beret or whatever, so they assumed I was off doing, you know, commando type of things. But they thought that Shannon was just the normal housewife, working mom, just like the rest of them. But yeah, you're right. I think because the military has such a male forward facing appearance for obvious reasons. People do forget that women in the military are going home and cooking meals and making photo albums and just doing all the regular mom type of stuff. And they balance all of that. And I think that's a much more difficult balancing act than it is being a working dad in the military, just because I think that, you know, most of society understands what a working dad is. But this working mother also being in the military is something that's relatively new.
Look at that, a macho Green Berets recognizing how hard working mothers work. That's good stuff right there. I want to thank both you guys for taking the time today to talk to Veteran Radio listeners about Send Me, the incredible true story of a mother at war. It's really the Shannon Kent story.
As I said at the outset, a hell of a mother, a hell of a warrior, hell of a patriot. And really great that we can pay honor to her here on Mother's Day.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Carrie Filippetti. She is the executive director of the Vandenberg Coalition, which we're going to talk about. But she also was involved in writing op-ed piece for the Washington Examiner, which is where I saw it earlier, about how civics education maybe could help solve the military recruitment crisis. So you'll want to listen to her here. Carrie, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. Excited to be here.
Well, you have a very interesting career path out of the University of Virginia with your degree and then on to work at the United Nations as a senior policy advisor for the United States mission. You advised then Ambassador Nikki Haley on issues related to counterterrorism in the Middle East and things in the Western Hemisphere. You've done work for the State Department in a lot of things down south, Venezuela, for example, and now find yourself as the executive director of the Vandenberg Coalition. Can you tell us a little bit about the Vandenberg Coalition?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I've been very fortunate to have great mentors like Ambassador Haley and others in the last administration that helped establish my career path. So the Vandenberg Coalition, we started it in 2021. I was just leaving the Trump administration and was concerned by what I was seeing as this rise in a sentiment of American retreat, the sense that America is no longer a powerful nation and should not seek to promote its interests and its values around the world. And as someone who grew up on the outskirts of New York City, you know, on 9/11, I'm very much aware that no matter how much we want to retreat from the world, our enemies are going to try to attack us, and it's going to cost far more American lives if we wait for that than if we address the threats in smaller ways before they get to our borders. So that was generally the impetus for the coalition. We wanted to create a network of conservative thought leaders, people who had served in government before, who could really create a new foreign policy for 2023 and going forward, not looking back at what previous presidents did, not saying everything that Reagan did was right or Bush did was right or Trump did was right, but really recognizing that we're in a completely different threat environment than we've ever faced before. And how do we appropriately confront that threat environment using both the new opportunities that technology provides us, as well as the new challenges and obstacles that we have with things like the rise of communist China. So the coalition exists to push for that kind of an agenda, to push for an American people first foreign policy that better serves American interests and promotes American prosperity, American freedom, and American strength.
Well, I have to admit that I didn't know who Senator Vandenberg was when I started researching. Hey, how do I talk to the author of this interesting idea? Only to learn that Arthur Vandenberg, who died in 1951, was a senator from my home state here in Michigan, and that he studied law at the University of Michigan, but made his mark in journalism before going on to the United States Senate. Tell us a little bit about Arthur Vandenberg and why that became the name of the coalition.
Absolutely. And it's not unusual. I mean, I'll be honest with you, when we started this group and we're trying to come up with the best name for it, I also was not familiar with Arthur Vandenberg up until, you know, meeting with some folks and then commending him to me. So as you mentioned, Arthur Vandenberg was a senator from Michigan. He served from 1928 until 1951, which is, of course, a very pivotal moment for American foreign policy. He was a true conservative, a true Republican, and for much of his life as a political leader, he was an isolationist. And then Pearl Harbor happened, and he had what is known as this sort of massive public conversion, the quote, speech heard round the world, where he subsequently said that our oceans have ceased to be moats, which automatically protect our ramparts, essentially acknowledging that no matter what we want here, no matter how much we want to avoid war, we have enemies and they are going to try to attack us unless we put up stronger defenses. And he ultimately became the chief architect for some of the most sort of modern forms of conservative foreign policy. So he was the chief legislative architect of the Marshall Plan, of NATO, of the UN and the Truman Doctrine. And he really established what it means to be a Republican leading in foreign policy in that post-World War era, and really set the stage for uniting conservatives around a strong foreign policy. So what we appreciated about him and why we chose his name is because he understood what it was like to be an isolationist. He understood why he needed to shift from that mentality and the kinds of threats that were in front of him. He remained true to his conservative roots, but at the same time was willing to work across the aisle to do what was best for the United States. And those are things that we all try to bring into the Vandenberg Coalition. So I'm hoping that part of what we do can help spread the word about this fantastic Michigan senator who really had an outsized influence on conservative foreign policy and American foreign policy, and yet very few people are familiar with his story.
Well, and I would encourage anybody who is interested in that story or the history, if you will, go to VandenbergCoalition.org. Go to the About Us tab and check down to who is Arthur Vandenberg. There's a nice explanation of all this, including the speech heard around the world after Pearl Harbor and sort of how he converted from, hey, United States, be an isolationist, just worry about your own area, to this recognition that, hey, we have internationalism here. We have to deal with the whole world. So very interesting, and I'd encourage people to look at it, Carrie. But before we lose too much more time, I want to come back to what caught my attention, which was your piece on Restoring America about, quote, how civics education can help solve the military recruitment crisis. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, as somebody who works in national security, obviously, you know, having a declining military capacity is central to many of my conversations. And of course, many of your listeners will know that the United States is experiencing one of the most significant recruitment crises. And by the way, retention crises that it has seen since the end of the draft. So the question is, what's spurring that forward? And there's a few different things. One thing is just, you know, medical records are now online. So while people in the past would be able to join the military and maybe they wouldn't divulge that they had, you know, ADD or they broke some bone at some point, now it's all online. And so the military has access to it. So some of those things need to be updated. Other things are just the physical fitness of our youth. So the stats that we've seen from 2020 suggest that only about 23% of Americans between the ages of 17 to 24 are even eligible for military service. And when you think about that number, then the question is how many of those want to serve? And that's where civic education really does play a significant role, because civics is all about teaching people about why our country was created, what we stand for, what our principles are, and why it's so important to preserve those things and fight for what it means to be an American and understand what it means to be an American and to integrate into America if you are, you know, immigrating here from another country. And so I think it makes sense that we're seeing a decline in interest in the military. You know, in the last year, in 2023, the only branches that met their recruitment targets were the Marine Corps and the Space Force. And you had about a 41,000 person shortfall in the Army, Navy, and Air Force. And so it's critically important that people understand why service matters so much. And I think that's where there's really been this gap. Throughout the last few decades, we've seen declining civic education in universities, declining civic education in K-12. Nobody is being taught why being an American matters and the good that it does for the world. And then therefore, why would anybody want to serve? So I think making sure that people are educated in those things is critical to inspiring them to want to serve their country, whether it's in the military or, frankly, whether it's through a corporation that can bring economic benefit back to the United States as well.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thought here, because this recruiting and retention problem is ultimately a national security problem. We've been talking about it with a lot of different thought leaders and writers and military men and women on Veterans Radio. And we're talking to Carrie Filippetti, who's the executive director of the Vandenberg Coalition. And I think some of this is related to, well, you know, that 1% of the population or less takes care of us. I don't have to involve my family. Whereas during World War II, certainly it was every family. During the Vietnam draft, because of the draft, it became almost every family. So we've really gone generations now where we think, when we don't think about it. Somebody else takes care of it for us. And it really people aren't taught. And this is the, you know, I grabbed the yellow marker when I read this line that you guys wrote, which is, if people are not taught why their country is worth defending, they are less inclined to serve in the military or contribute their skills to its success. It's really that simple, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, again, what people are being taught today in schools, particularly universities, but even at the K-12 level now, is that America is bad, that America has a scary, problematic history. And rather than reading America through the lens of this, what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called the promissory note, right, this idea that we would always seek to be a more perfect union, instead of understanding that as the root of what it means to be an American, people are trying to say that what it means to be an American are, you know, accepting and being, you know, racist or being opposed to other cultures. And that's not at all what it is about. That's not what it has been about. And I think there's a way of teaching the reality of you know, American history with a very clear understanding of what a beautiful system the United States has created and how different and unique it is among all of the nations in the world. There used to be institutions that would do these. You know, I was a Girl Scout. I'm sure many of your listeners were Boy Scouts. And by the way, the correlation between those who are Eagle Scouts and those who serve in the military or do exceptional things is unbelievable.
Absolutely. Yep.
So, and we no longer have an emphasis on those sort of civics-minded organizations. We don't teach it in schools anymore. We don't teach the Pledge of Allegiance anymore. We don't teach the founding documents anymore. And giving people the tools to understand how the United States has grown and developed, if you really understand our history, you will be inspired to serve this country, whether it is through the military or some other capacity if for whatever reason you don't meet the fitness requirements. But people today are just not excited to be American. People today don't think that their children are going to have a better future than they will. So this is all part of this broader cultural decline and cultural malaise where we just no longer have confidence in the United States anymore. So why would somebody young decide to put their life on the line for the country? And that's where civics education, I think, can make a significant difference.
Yeah, we don't teach history at all. And the little bit we do teach is often slanted against this idea of why your country is worth defending. You had a co-author on the article, Hans Zeiger, I believe, from the Jack Miller Center. Can you tell us a little bit about that relationship?
Sure. So Hans is the leader of the Jack Miller Center, which is a fantastic organization that builds and sustains a higher education community that's focused on the teaching of civic education. So they create resources and teacher education for those individuals who will be teaching others about what it means to be an American. So they're very much involved in this, what they call the civics knowledge crisis. They focus on teaching about the American political tradition. They host a summit on civics education and have something called the Constitution Day Initiative, which I think would be fantastic for. I'm trying to get more people to celebrate Constitution Day, which is September 17th, which marks the signing of the U.S. Constitution. They work very, very hard on trying to promote civics education and have been involved in this space for many, many years, a lot longer than I have. So Hans is a brilliant leader of this organization and also the co-author of this op-ed.
So here becomes the important question. Okay, guys like me read this and said, that's a really good idea. How has it been received by the educational world, though? You're saying, hey, we have to teach this down in the lower grades. Any feedback from the educational world yet?
You know, I think there is this recognition, and it's growing as we start to see how some of these initiatives that were intended to sort of recognize issues within the United States, things like the, you know, DEI initiatives and so on. Lately, there's been a lot of pushback against those things as we're seeing it play out, you know, with respect to the crisis in the Middle East and how it seems people are unable to kind of differentiate good versus evil at this stage. And so the education space, I think, is ripe for change. And now is the moment for us to focus on this aspect, regardless of your beliefs on, DEI or other things. I think civics education is a central pillar of making good citizens, citizens that want to contribute. So far, we've started to get a little bit more interest as that community, the educational community, is opening itself up to recognizing, you know, maybe we've made some mistakes, and seeing how different leaders of universities are being forced out because of those mistakes. So I'm hoping that now is really the moment, but it does require people like you, people like your viewers, people like me, as we, you know, if we have children, to push for civics education there, to try to get our children enrolled in things like, you know, the Scouts programs, to be involved as community leaders, because those are the types of people that will be inspired to want to serve the country as well. So there's a lot that we can be doing at the local level.
Well, that's a really great interview, and you can hear the full interview on Veterans Radio's podcast, which you can find at all the normal outlets, Spotify, Google, Amazon. Look for Veterans Radio America and check out our podcast, which we post every Tuesday. We always appreciate our sponsors, our VSO sponsors like VVA, Chapter 310, VFW, Post 423, American Legion, Post 46, all in Ann Arbor. And if you're in a position that maybe your post could be also sponsor Veterans Radio, or you individually or your corporation, go to our website, veteransradio.org, check it out, and I'm sure we can find a level at which your support will be meaningful to us. We have a dining fundraiser coming up at the Carlisle Grill in the Ann Arbor area on Sunday the 26th of May, so maybe you can go out and have a nice meal and help support Veterans Radio. We'd love to see you. We'll be out there. So stop in anytime during the dinner service to support Veterans Radio. And until next week on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.